Okay, Rob, what do you say? Marv's 8:35, I believe. And I'm not intending to finish late. Absolutely. I'm as hungry as you. And this is the about the third drosha that I'm giving today. So consequently, you can understand that I'm also anxious to eat. I'm not going to be all the time. I wanted to start with a very interesting observation, pshat, a very nice pshat, by Rav Chaim Kanievsky Shlita, in his Perush on Eicha. And he notes an apparent contradiction in the very first pasuk of Eicha. And he has the following. Eicha Yoshua Vadod, Rabosi Bagoyim, Sarlosi Bamadinos, Hoyesolomas. Eicha Yoshua Vadod, the Gemara says in Yuma, did you get up to there yet in Dafyomi? It's approximately Dafnun Beis. Not there yet?
No.
Right? So the Gemara says that for 50 some odd years, lay over Ishbi Yehuda. After the first Churban HaMikdash, it's really what the Novi alludes to today in the Torah we read this morning. Nova do Alohu. That's it. There's nobody there when the animals didn't come, because animals live because of the byproducts of human existence. And they don't even have that. They don't have the garbage that the humans throw out. So the animals were Eifah Shemayim, they also left. It was desolate. The end of the Pasuk, Hoy Solomas, indicates something else. Hoy Solomas indicates that they were present, but they were subjugated. It's a very common term. Vayulomas means that a king extends his domination over a population. And that's Vayulomas. They pay taxes there. They're subjugated there. So which one is it? If there was nobody there, there was nobody to be subjugated. Who was Hoy Solomas? So he says that Yirmiyahu addressed a very significant issue in the very first possible Eicha. And that is that Klal Yisrael, Yirmiyahu as it were himself, was troubled with the fact, is it conceivable that the non-Jewish nations of the world who destroyed the Beis HaMikdash, could they have conceivably been on a higher spiritual level than the Jewish people? It's true, oh, but we sinned. If the Rebbeinu Shalom punished us by bringing Devar, as David HaMelech asked at the end of Shmuel, that was David HaMelech's request. He had three options. He said he wanted to come directly from the hands of the Rebbeinu Shalom himself without any human hands intervening. He's best off that way, and he was correct. So if it came directly from the hands of the Rebbeinu Shalom, the Yirmiyahu says, I can understand it. But the Kazdim, the people of Bovel, of Nebuchadnezzar, were more righteous than Klal Yisrael. The Romans were more righteous than Klal Yisrael. So on what basis were they empowered to destroy the Beis HaMikdash? That's what Yirmiyahu wanted to know. The answer, he says, to that question is Hoy Solomas. The way Rav Chaim Kanievsky learns, he has, in fact, in terms of Bayis Rishon, more than one interpretation. One I don't want to go into now, it's a little complex. I'm going to the second interpretation. Chazal say that when the Gemara says in Yuma that Bayis Rishon was destroyed because we were involved in the three cardinal sins, Avodah Zarah, Gidei Arayos, and Shvichas Dam. We were so steeped in Avodah Zarah that we were not comfortable with the homegrown brands of Avodah Zarah. The ones that were readily accessible in our part of the Middle East were not yet satisfying. Klal Yisrael sent emissaries to Kazdim, to Babylonia, that they should send their teachers to teach us how to be Oyegan with the Zohar in the manner of the Kazdim. It's a little far away, 1,100 miles away from Eretz Yisrael. It's a Choshev Avodah Zarah there. We wanted to make sure that we participated in that one too. Chaim Kanievsky writes, this is the Pshat Hoy Solomas. We empowered the Kazdim by subjugating ourselves to their Avodah Zarah. This is what gave Nebuchadnezzar the ability to destroy, to produce Eicha Yoshua Vadot, to destroy the Beis HaMikdash. The Gemara Avodah Zarah says, and the Ramban cites this at the beginning of Parshas by Yishlach, that 180 years before the Churban Beis HaMikdash, in the infighting in the house of Beis Chashmonoi between Aristobulus and Hyrcanus, that one wished to gain the upper hand, and 180 years before the Korban, they brought a Roman official to come to serve as some type of viceroy for the Roman Empire, in effect empowering him to rule in Eretz Yisrael. And the Ramban points out that this is ultimately how we brought about the destruction of the Beis HaMikdash. And Rav Chaim Kanievsky states that this indeed is the only way that the Romans could have destroyed the Beis HaMikdash. So we had not empowered them in Eretz Yisrael, there's no way the Rabbeinu Shalom would have granted them the ability to conquer Eretz Yisrael. What I learned from this is it's sad in our history, it's sad it is, but on the other side, there's an upside to this as well. And the upside to it is that even at the time when the Rabbeinu Shalom destroyed the Mikdash, it's not because you utterly rejected Klal Yisrael. But as at the very end of the Teichacha, we read, the Rabbeinu Shalom still had use for Klal Yisrael. They still served a purpose for him. We, unfortunately, deepened the misery with which we would enter into by our own actions. But the Rabbeinu Shalom, in terms of his yachas to Klal Yisrael, did not feel compelled to punish Klal Yisrael in such a fashion. He was still an avon, a chesed to Klal Yisrael, and the many midrashim would tell us this. Which makes it very, very significant that there's an observation of Rav Kook, Zeichat Tzadik Lebracha, and it's one that we have to focus on as Tisha B'Av closes. And Rav Kook tells us, the Gemara says in Yuma again, and the Tessam at Beis, that by Hashem he was nechrav because of sinas chinam. And as the Chofetz Chaim implores us in the Hagdoma to say for Chofetz Chaim, that if we wish to rebuild the Beis HaMikdash, as the Rishalmi in Yuma states, that kol dar shalo nivna b'yoma, if it wasn't rebuilt in Ades, kilu nechrav b'yoma, it's Rishalmi Yuma in the first paragraph, Aleph, I believe, Aloha Aleph, that we have to take some measure, some steps towards correcting deficiencies which brought about the Korban of the Beis HaMikdash. And he says, Rav Kook, Zatzal, that if Sinas Chinam destroyed the Beis HaMikdash, then Abbas Chinam will rebuild the Beis HaMikdash. That's the imperative that we have to have. The Abbas Yisrael comes in a number of different levels. There's Abbas Yisrael of great people, great tzaddikim. There's Abbas Yisrael of Poshet the Jews. But I'm going to tell you, their Abbas Yisrael at times is not Poshet. There's Abbas Yisrael of the Chofetz Chaim, Zeichat Tzadik Lebracha. It's important to know, but again, that's the Chofetz Chaim. But then I'll share with you an incident of simple, the Poshet. The Chofetz Chaim had a nephew, obviously before the First World War, was learning in Yeshiva in Russia, and he decided one Shabbos he's going home. He took the train, and he lived in Stachin in Poland. Stachin is the city where Chaim Shmulevitz came from. And he was traveling to that city, and either the Russian or the Polish railroad was not exactly efficient, and during the night he realizes that he's never going to make it to Stachin before Shabbos comes. So he wonders, what's he going to do? He can't stay on the train forever, he has to get off somewhere. So he goes to the conductor and he asks him to tell him all the stations that the train is going to pass through on the way to Stachin. So he tells him, and he lights up, he tells him the station, which happens to be near Rab. Now he was a great nephew of the Chofetz Chaim, so he said, listen, if I can't make it home, it's not a bad trade-off, I'll go spend Shabbos with the Chofetz Chaim, my great uncle, it's not a bad idea. So he gets off, and he probably has to hire a balagol. I don't believe that the train actually stopped in Rab itself, I would hardly doubt. And he finally comes to the Chofetz Chaim's house Friday afternoon. He's dead tired. It's been a lengthy journey. And the Chofetz Chaim tells him to lay down and rest until Shabbos. He lays down, he rests. The Chofetz Chaim, you know, goes and says, I'll see you. I'm going to go to shul meanwhile. And he wakes up later. He wakes up. The Chofetz Chaim greets him warmly. He asks him to come to the table. The Chofetz Chaim makes Kiddush. The Rebbe sits down. They have Suda Shabbos. And the Chofetz Chaim excuses himself. He says, you know, I'm very tired. I'm knocked out. I'm sorry. I can't sit up to spend time with you. I'll see you tomorrow. He goes off to sleep. This fellow goes to lay down, and he just can't fall asleep. It doesn't work. So a short while later, he gets up, he wanders around the house, he goes into the kitchen, and the clock reads 4 a.m. He's a little bit flabbergasted, because he didn't fall asleep. It's not long after the Suda, 15 minutes, half an hour after the Suda ended. But how is it 4 o'clock in the morning? He doesn't know what to make of this. Morning comes, and he goes to the Rebbetzin, and he says, tell me, Tanta, this clock in the kitchen, it's accurate or not accurate? What's the story here? She says, no, the clock is very highly accurate. So now he really scratches his head. So how could it be? He said, shortly after the meal, I couldn't sleep. I got out of bed and it said 4 a.m. So what happened? So normally in the Chofetz Chaim's Mishpacha, they didn't talk about such things. But the Chofetz, I guess in honor of his great nephew, he was willing to level. So the Rebbe says, I'll tell you. Chofetz Chaim came back from shul, and I wanted to wake you up for kiddush. So the Chofetz Chaim says, how can you wake him up for kiddush? He's knocked out. He had a long train ride. Let him sleep. So he kept sleeping for a while. So finally, the Chofetz Chaim said to me that our son Aaron should make kiddush for me, and we should eat. And he's going to sit and learn. And when you get up, he'll make kiddush for you. And we made up that when he makes kiddush for you, I'm going to come back to the table. I'll eat again with you, so you'll feel that you're having your regular Seder Shabbos. And you obviously got up somewhere, it's 2:30, quarter to 3 in the morning. That's when you got up. That's why you're shortly after the meal ended. It's 4 o'clock in the morning. But this was the notion, the Chofetz Chaim is obviously wrong. And we're going to come back in a moment. It's obviously not only for his great nephew, but it's obviously wrong for everyone. But I want to tell you a story of Poshut Yid. Guys like you, me, you know, us guys, you know, not the Chofetz Chaim up there, guys that we could readily relate to. I have a Chavra Sefer. And one day, a man, an elderly man, comes into a store. And a very tragic life. He was a Holocaust survivor. He had been a young man yet when the Holocaust ended. And he had a wife and one child before the war. And the war ended, and he lost his wife and child in the war. And for whatever reason, 50 years went by, he never remarried. He was an old man, circa 1995, 50 years after the war. He had no wife, he had no children, he had no relatives. He lived in Brighton Beach, Manhattan Beach, his whole life. He used to go to shul there, but he was a very lonely man. So one day, these two, he was an old man, a couple of guys drove him to the store. And they sit in the front, he goes in the back, he tells them, he says, I'm worse off than a potato, than a kartoffel, he tells them. And the Shema, he says, a potato, you take it and you plant it in the ground, it'll produce other potatoes. He says, when I'm gone and they put me into the ground, that's the end of me. He says, I left nothing behind in this world behind me. So I want to leave some memorial for my wife and for my child, some zikaron for myself. So I decided I want to write a Sefer Torah and donate it to the local shul, so that at least after me it'll be some zecher that I lived in this world that my family once existed. So he tells him, fine. The man sits with him, he picks out the Sefer Torah that he wants. He tells him, okay, things will go on. A while goes by, the man calls him up and says, listen, I want you to come pick up a deposit. I live down in Manhattan Beach. Please come to my house. And my friend says, fine. He gets in the car, he drives down there. And the man takes out $9,842. And he gives him, that's the deposit. My friend is scratching his head. You know, when they give him $9,000, $9,500, $10,000, $98,000. He just can't make sense of what happened. But he doesn't want to say anything. He says, thank you very much. And he goes back. Finally, the Sefer Torah is finished. He delivers the Sefer Torah to the shul in Manhattan Beach. A check comes in due order from the shul. That's it. And everything's fine. Shalom HaYisrael. 2 or 3 years go by. And he hears that the man passed away. And involved, I guess, the shiv or the shloshim, he meets up again with these two guys that showed up in the store that drove this man to this day. And he's pretty swift, my friend. So he says to him, he says, tell me, he says, I sense that something peculiar took place in this story with the Sefer Torah. And he'd like you guys to level with me. So they said, well, now that our friend is not here, if you asked us, we'll tell you exactly what happened. It was always on his mind that he wanted to write a Sefer Torah. And that's what he felt is the one thing that he could leave behind in this world. He has nothing else to leave behind. The only problem is that he was a very simple man. He never made too much money in his life. And his $9,800, whatever that he gave you, that's all the money that he had for the Sefer Torah. So he asked us, he says, how's he going to get a Sefer Torah? $9,800? So we told him, the two of us, don't worry about it. We'll go to the Sefer, we'll speak to him, and we'll work it out for you that you get a Sefer Torah for $9,800. What he didn't know is that the rest of the money, another $10,000 or $20,000, whatever it may have been at that time, the two of us paid for. We gave the money to the shul paid for it, and that's it. Shalom HaYisrael, he went, you know, we left the Sefer Torah behind. The rest of it, he did not know what took place. Now, lest you think that these were two very money people that could easily do this, one of them told my chavar, he says, I want to write a Sefer Torah for myself. It's on my agenda. But I don't yet have the money together for it. I'm hoping yet in coming years I'll succeed in pulling together enough money to write a Sefer Torah for myself. When it came for a memorial for this Yid, that it was life's quest to feel, to leave this world with a measure of comfort, he reached into his pocket unflinchingly. He spent the money, didn't ask any questions, didn't worry how the money will be spent. To buy his own Sefer Torah, he's not ready to do it. He doesn't have the money to do it. But this is the Avos Yisrael that we have to have. Avos Yisrael has to encompass Rabbi Yisai, and I want to be very brave. The kids are 5 minutes tomorrow. Not only those that we are like, but those that are very unlike us too. And that's the bane of Jewish existence. We are a crazy people. I tell you, we are crazy. And you can tell the whole world in my name that I said we are crazy. And I'll tell you very simply why. Imagine that we had no divisiveness in the Jewish people whatsoever. What, there were 15, 16 million Jews in the world, sometimes such type of number like that. I'm not a demographer, but somewhere in that range. Now imagine we gathered all 15, 16 million and we're absolutely united. All cylinders firing exactly to the same goals constantly. We would have a very daunting challenge to survive all the things that we have to survive in this world. So we're the only people in the world that could have the mazel that for 2,000 years almost, our primary adversary was the Roman Catholic Church, with 500 million adherents. And when we traded them in and left Western and Central Europe, so what did we do? We had to discover the one religion in the world that has a billion adherents, you know? Why couldn't we get in a fight with the Baha'is that have 100,000, you know? Not our model. It doesn't happen. So if we gathered our 15, 16 million people together in absolute unity, it would be a daunting challenge to survive. You know, unfortunately, and as you mentioned earlier today, I have never spent such a poignant Tisha B'Av in my life. I've been through, listen, I'm born, as most of you sitting in this room, I was born after the Holocaust. So I don't remember in my memory a Tisha B'Av which should have been a time of crisis for Klaus. I remember many days of crisis. I remember the Six-Day War when it took place. I remember the trepidation in the weeks which preceded it. I remember the Yom Kippur War. I remember Shlomo HaGadol. Many, many things which took place in Eretz Yisrael. I remember in times of extreme crisis for Klal Yisrael. I remember very, very well. But Tisha B'Av that had been spent in crisis, I don't remember. The poignant backdrop to today's events. Are we Jews, which great Maminim, we have such Maminim and everything else. The Rabbeinu Shalom said, Netzach Yisrael lo Yishaka, we're eternal. So we weren't worrying about how we're going to survive. So we can have all our petty fights and spend, instead of putting our klichas together, we'll beat each other up. That's great. You know, we're crazy. We're absolutely out of our minds. I mentioned earlier this year, shortly before I left, that from Pinchas we learn a phenomenal lesson. Pinchas, after he slays Zimri, this was not a very popular action, as you could well understand. I mean, to slay a Nossi and Klal Yisrael was not going to go down too well in Moshe Rabbeinu. If Moshe Rabbeinu did it, it would have been bad enough, but this was not Moshe Rabbeinu. And as Rashi writes at the beginning of Pinchas, they told them, you, Shavi Imo, your grandfather, Pite Magolim Lavoy the Zohar, Rashi on Putil. So Rashi tells us, you all of a sudden decided that you're this holy man that has the right to be a Kanoi? Who in the world do you think you are? So the Medrash tells us in the Yalkut Shemoni at the end of Bolo that the citizens, the denizens of Shevet Shimon came forth and they wanted to break his bones for him. So the Rebbeinu Shel sent them Malach and he comes to strike them down. As he comes to strike them down, Pinchas is appalled. Why? Yidden are falling. Jews are being hurt. Pinchas, this is your moment of vindication. Everyone decries your action. And the Rebbeinu Shel Olam is publicly taken up for you. Could there be a more satisfying moment? Pinchas is devastated by the moment. The Medrash tells us this is the meaning of the Pasuk in Tillim, by your fellow Pinchas. He's mispalo. Save them, Rabbeinu Shalom. I don't care that you say that you're destroying them for my good. Save Eden. Obviously, Yisrael has to include not only those that are like us, our adversaries too, to the extent it's humanly possible. And we have people that are not such, we don't have the extreme adversaries that Pinchas had. The adversaries that we have, no, they're from guys, Asfardis, Ashkenazis, Payas, the cries of the Payas, you know, doesn't have Payas, a Gartel, whatever, he has a Kippa Sruga, a Black, a Chais, the whole things that we Jews could make up, and to subdivide these tiny people into different groups. I'm still looking for the Chazal that says in Shemayim, they're going to ask you what Shevet you came from, and decide which part of Gan Eden you're getting into. I didn't find such a Chazal yet. When we come upstairs, they're going to ask us, were we Amina? Did we learn Torah? Did we have Avos Yisrael? Those are the questions they're going to ask us. Exactly what type of jacket we wore, what type of yarmulke, what tzitzis were in or out, you know? And if they had black stripes, white stripes, or no stripes, you know? They're not going to ask us. They're going to ask us different questions. I'll end very quickly with two maisim. There was a fellow that came to the yeshiva in Radin. He wanted to apply to the yeshiva. And he was intellectually capable, but some of the Talmidim in Yeshiva recognized the fact that he was a communist. He was involved in communist activities elsewhere. This was a problem early in the 20th century. So they came to the Chofetz Chaim, not only the Chofetz Chaim says you can't take some Bokhram into the Yeshiva, you can pull who knows how many Bokhram out of the Yeshiva and leave from Kaid and become communists. So he asked for a shus at least. He says, I'm not from Radin, I should be able to sleep the night in the Yeshiva. So the Chofetz Chaim said, he can't sleep the night in the shiur. So the Bochur asked on Hulu, what should I do? He said, go to the Chofetz Chaim, I'll tell you what to do. He came to the Chofetz Chaim's house. He says, Rebbe, you don't let me into the shiur. What should I do? I can't sleep in the street tonight. Chofetz Chaim said, no problem, sleep in my house. My house, you can sleep in. You're welcome to be my guest. You can imagine with the day that took place, this Bochur didn't sleep too much that night. And in the middle of the night, he notes that the Chofetz Chaim walks into his room, and he feels that the ear feels a little bit chilly. The Chofetz Chaim takes off his kapot and covers him with his kapot. And this had a very, very powerful effect on him for the rest of his life. He has a bochur that the Chofetz Chaim personally banished from yeshivas, and was unfit to sleep one night in yeshiva in Radin. But at his house, at his guest, he went in the middle of the night to check it was a little too chilly. He took off his own kapot to cover him that he shouldn't come to. I led with a mice, a phenomenal mice of Rabbi Yitzchak of Berdichev. And this revised, it blew me away, and all of us have to aspire to this. His minig was that on Sukkot he invited guests into his sukkah, but he had an unusual clientele. The lowest echelons of the Jewish society in Berdichev are the ones that he invited. The guys that you weren't even sure you wanted to let him to shul the whole year, these are the guys that were his guests in the sukkah of Berdichev. And finally it reached a point that the Nechbodi HaKol, the elders of Berdichev, came to him and said, Rebbe, what in the world is this about? I mean, these guys don't belong there. He should have Talmidei Chachamim, Big Balei Tzedaka, pious Jews, but these guys, what in the world do you have these guys in the sukkah for? So the Berdichev said, I'll tell you. He said, I look forward that Mashiach's going to come. And when Mashiach comes, they're going to make the sukkah Shalom Yosef, and they're going to make a big sukkah, and I'm going to come to the door, I'm going to want to get it. I'm afraid when I'm going to come to the door, they're going to say, Levi Yitzchak, what in the world do you want to come? Who are you to think that you have the right to walk in here? You think you're a tzaddik or something? You have a right to come into the sukkah? So I'm going to tell them, Rabbi Yisai, in my sukkah, I let everybody in. And that's chus you have to let me into. And Rabbi Yisai, we have to embrace all of Klal Yisrael, all of us, to expand outward beyond the immediate our type, to embrace other types and choose to. They should also be included in the Ahavas Yisrael. And that's chus that the Rabbeinu Shalom should quickly let all of us in to the sukkah of Yosef Rabbi Yisai.